Automated Creative are on a mission to reinvent advertising using artificial intelligence. We're a small team of startup folk who are really changing the way that advertising works. In the last few years, we've worked with brands like Adidas, Samsung, Diageo, Reckitt, KFC, Pernod Ricard, Bose, Unilever, GSK, Mondelez, the list goes on. And we are looking for account management talent. So if you know anyone who is kind of obsessed with creativity, ads, AI, and account management, if you could get them to email Rhoda at automatedcreative.net. That's Rhoda, R-H-O-D-A, at automatedcreative.net. And I will love you forever. On with the show. Hello and welcome to the Shiny New Object Podcast. My name is Tom Ollerton. I'm the founder of Automated Creative. And this is a weekly show about the future of marketing. Every week or so, I have the pleasure and the privilege of interviewing one of our industry's leaders. And this week is no different. I'm on a call with Kieran Foley, who is head of partnerships and licensing at Danone. Kieran, for anyone listening to this podcast who isn't aware of who you are and what you do, could you give them an overview?
I think other than my mother who may listen to this, I would imagine that's the majority, Tom. So sure thing, I'd be happy to. Irish born and bred, if you haven't heard it in the accent. I went to university there, started my world in tech, went through CPG or FMCG, as they call it in Europe, CPG, as they call it in the States. So basically the Heineken. And got my first kind of major role with O2 in Ireland, and I headed up sponsorship there. So I was lucky to do some of the big deals like Irish Rugby, English Rugby, the O2 Arena, the Ryder Cup European Open. So it was a fun time. It was really, really cool. I moved from there to Digicel, which was a communications company started in the Caribbean. When I was there, it was in 12 markets. Very quickly went to being in 32 markets across two continents. I started as the head of sponsorships and rose to being the chief marketing officer there. We were about a $2.5 billion revenue company with about 18 million customers. That was all about growth in emerging markets. So it was a fun time. And the company moved to being a quad play company, which basically means we did media as well as phones and broadband, et cetera, a lot of content. I went back, I started my own consulting then. I did some stuff. I tried to broker the sale of a Premier League team to some Asian individuals. And I moved back into CPG recently at Danone, where I head up partnerships and licensing, which effectively means I look after all of our partnership programs from the NFL to Disney to NBC Universal to charities to sustainability programs, etc. So it's a major company. It's great to get back into a big American powerhouse. Well, they're French actually, but we're headquartered in the US market in New York. And it's great to be part of a big company again. One thing I left out was during my trip, probably one of my highlights of my career was I conceived, created and developed a cricket league, which is now number two in the world, called CPL T20. And it took me about 2-3 years to do that, but hell of a lot of fun. And it's really great to see it every year just doing ever so well.
Right. So tell me more about that. How did that particular invention, so you created it, you conceived it, you got it up and running?
Yeah. So funny story. Well, not funny story. We were when I was at Digicel, I was the head of sponsorships originally and then the CMO. And during my time there, we sponsored the West Indies Cricket Board. There was an awful lot of competitive elements around that. And a chap named Alan Stanford, who was a billionaire financier who had owned a bank actually in Antigua, he sponsored an event called the T20 for 20. And effectively, he took the West Indies team, called them his team, and brought in our competitors. So long story short, we had to go to High Court in London and follow some legal challenges to protect our rights. Now, I will say this is after several attempts to try and mitigate the issue and find a resolve that was amicable for everybody, which just wasn't going to happen in the end. So we were left to have to defend our rights because we paid up to 10 million a year, and it was just not okay to just completely usurp our rights. So after we won that hands down, including awards of damages, we then settled and look, it got going. Now, my chairman at the time spoke to me and said, listen, what's the story here? Because obviously these are not good partners, but they were in financial trouble. So what I did was manage to speak to the chairman and said, look, I understand that marketing is going one way and cost is going the other way. And so the value of this product isn't any, is not on the face of it good. But what is an unspoken data point is that, and you wouldn't know it if you looked at data and just spreadsheets and the fact of media numbers or what was going on in content. The reality was, this is intrinsic to the culture of the people of the West Indies, which was the heartbeat of where the company started. Now, the reality was, they were under English rule for so many years. They came out of it and got their independence in the 60s, 70s, different countries, obviously, at different times. And they were able to not just compete, but beat and remain unbeaten and be number one in the world, including beating the English team in a test cricket in the 80s with the likes of Mikey Holding and Lance Gibbs and Viv Richards. I mean, these guys are legends. These people are just absolute legends inside all the countries of the Caribbean. And they competed and were number one in the world. And they brought the countries of the West Indies to a place that was unthought of prior. And so it's the cultural value of the sport was far beyond any data point or what was occurring at the time. The reality being, you needed to understand that the sport itself, and I'm not, my background is footballer, soccer, if you're in America, but, and I left out that I actually played professionally during my time as well. So I understood that the sport could have that unwritten dimension on people's interaction with brands. And I knew that if we just cut it loose, we'd be in serious trouble because our brand had, you know, it had a massive affinity rate. It was up in the high 80s and a 98% awareness level. So we were bigger than Coke. We used to love saying that. But the reason we were was because we got inside the community. We worked and we were interactive. And we understood what value was to people's lives, their culture and their interactivity. So it wasn't just a data point. So it was very important that we not lose that. But we're a company, so we can't keep spending loads of money and not getting enough value out of it. So I came up with an idea of saying, listen, this new fad has started called the T20 cricket. In India, they're making money hand over fist. Everywhere else in the world, they have failed in trying to replicate this. Bangladesh tried and failed. Sri Lanka tried and failed. The only other place that was kind of doing okay was Australia. And they had the big bash. But in the West Indies, they had tried to do it. But obviously, this guy, Stanford, he just poured. At the time, it was unknown what he was doing. It came out and he's since been arrested by the federal authorities in the States. But that's another story. But the reality was that I could see that there was a model there. Now, I've been lucky in developing, restructuring the soccer, or football, as we call it, across the Caribbean and Central America under UNCAF and the CFU, which are the two bodies that sit under CONCACAF, which is the body that looks after football for North America and the Caribbean. And essentially what I did was I said to my boss, look, I think that we could make a business model here if we take the rights of this new fad, own it, develop it, structure it, and roll it out. So he said, okay, tell me how you're going to do it. So over the course of a year and a half, I devised a commercial model. I agreed a sanctioning a contract, which was a 50-year deal, which in and of itself is the only one of its kind in the world. The only one close to it would have been what Eccleston did with Formula One, where they took all the commercial rights, what left the authorities of the actual sport under the governance of the international body itself. So it was super important that it was official cricket. But it was also super important that we had the destiny on the commercial rights, because we had to make it as a commercial product. So we ran it out with six franchises. I agreed with governments exactly how we would place it inside their countries and how they would host it. I sold three of the six franchises in the first year, and it was rolled out to massive success. And in year two, we broke even, actually turned a slight profit by selling the other three teams that were there. So it's gone hugely successful. It's over 250 million people watching it. It's in year eight, just finished. So it's now number two in the world. And that was a fun, brilliant period where there was a marketing problem and a challenge, and we turned it into an advantage and a new business and a new commercial avenue.
So within that experience and your many other varied experiences, what is your top marketing tip? What is the bit of advice that stood you in good stead and find yourself sharing most often?
Yeah, I think I'm a great believer in having information, and information is usually based on the data that you receive, the media reports, a very clear understanding about, you know, all the insights that you do, all of that. I'm a huge believer in having as much data as you can, but I'm also a huge believer in having that unspoken understanding about how do you create commerce and interactivity. So it's not just the visible data on your spreadsheet, but the understanding you have of what the cultural impact is and what the impact is on people and how you can make a clearer interactivity for them to create that avenue of commerce. So if you just leave it as a spreadsheet, and it's an obvious truism to say, you know, there's more than just what's there in the spreadsheet, but it's the understanding, getting into the nuances of where this has come from, how it was progressed, why it is the way it is, how do we speak to different cultures or different segments within that, and is this the best vehicle to do it? It may not be exploited at the time because it's tired or it's old or, you know, there's been had poor management. There's lots of different reasons. So, and I've seen that when I joined Digicel, it was at 10, 12 markets, and we soon rolled out to being in 32. Every time we went into a new market, we understood the culture as much as we understood the commerce, and so that we could really resonate and become locally real and locally relevant and really part of the culture as quickly as we could.
And so how do you advise people to do that? I mean, it's one thing saying, yeah, read the numbers, but also understand the cultural context within which you're operating. But I know, like, say you're going to a completely new market that you may have heard of, you'd hope, but never actually been there. How do you as an outsider learn that?
Having worked for tech companies, obviously I'm a big proponent of tech and using that. And I love this, you know, you can work from home. But if ever there was a big contract or a big deal, I would never, ever sign it without flying over, going face to face. I've never signed any personality ever. And I've signed some of the biggest personalities and sports personalities and music personalities the world has ever known. And I would never do it without sitting down and knowing the person or the property. So I'll give you an example. My first place that I went to was Haiti. And so before I went to Haiti, I looked on the websites and the FBI websites and the various Googled it and looked at all these websites. And effectively, they were saying at the time, look, unless you're an NGO or you're part of something very, very specific, this is not in the destiny that you should go to. And that the levels of education were lower than normal. The poverty levels were actually higher than normal. So there was a lot of pointers that you'd say, oh my goodness, there's no way you could launch a business and effectively do so well there. But then I went to Haiti, and I went to the Iron Market is a very well-known place in Petionville, which is one of the main areas in Cap-Haïtien in Haiti. And you would not believe the amount of people that were around doing commerce and bartering and trying to, live, survive, create new ways of working. It was unbelievable. The people are there are so ingenious. If they did one job, I found they would do 2 to 3 jobs. It would not just be one thing that they could do. And so my point is that if you read it, you'd think there's no way we can do business there. But if you actually went there and you realized, yeah, I've got to change my model. I can't have the same pricing. But the quantities here and the levels that we could get to are exponential. We just have to give these people access because they will take up on it. So it was that understanding that, you know, I know people say get your hands dirty, literally getting into the crowds to understand how it ticks, to understand exactly how people work, how you create that interaction with them. And I could never have gotten that on a data point. You need to walk the streets. You needed to understand it. You needed to get involved. And that's one thing that I've always tried to do, yeah.
This episode of the Shiny New Object podcast is brought to you in partnership with Manfest. Whether it's live in London or streamed online to the global marketing community, you can always expect a distinctive and daring blend of fast-paced content, startup innovation pitches, and unconventional entertainment from Madfest events. You'll find me causing trouble on stage, recording live versions of this podcast, and sharing a beer with the nicest and most influential people in marketing. Check it out at www.madfestlondon.com. So we're at the halfway point now, and we're going to talk about your shiny new object, which is one we've never had before on this podcast. So I'm grateful for it. And it's the growth potential of women's sport. So why is that your shiny new object for the marketing industry? And
so I've been fortunate in my new role at Danone, where I've come across and I've been in various committees and groups where I've across some of the leaders of the bigger brands that get involved in partnerships and programming. And a lot of them have especially after the pandemic, have had questions over value and how do we create new ways of interactivity with consumers, especially as we go into this new world that's a lot more not in person, but rather media driven or content driven. So there's always been the obvious understandings of the big marquee global brands and leagues and sports, etc., entertainment as well. That's changed a bit. You saw huge drops in numbers during the pandemic for various reasons. But what was really interesting was the rise of women's sport. And it wasn't so much just a tokenism, but when you see what the women's soccer team, especially the States, how they've taken not just the sport, but society. You have players from the National Women's Soccer League in the States going to Congress or going to speak to the president about equality. I know that the men's basketball team, they've stood up for, in the States especially, they stood up for various rights, Black Lives Matter, equality, inclusivity, diversity, etc. But the vehicles and the ways in which women are doing it and the women's sport are doing it, if you look at UEFA, they've tripled the size of the payments for the prize winners of the Champions League. FIFA, likewise, they've increased for the FIFA World Cup. The Irish national team have now taken payment of women and men on the exact same level on their contracts. And so it's just massive, the sea change and the development. But what I found really interesting and really positive is that men are 40% likely to watch women's sport and 60% likely to uptake on any commercial activity as a result of a brand being involved in women's programming. So it's no longer what it used to be. However, media is less than 2% of global media is afforded to women's sport. Now, it was less than 1% about 3 or 4 years ago. So some could say, hey, it's doubled. It's still nowhere near where it should be. But I see nothing but massive growth potential for it. Sponsorship dollars have been down. Again, they've increased. But globally, it's about the 1.5% to 2% of total global sponsorship dollars go into women's sport. But it has increased in the last few years, especially. Again, nowhere near the levels it should be. But when I look at it from a brand perspective, not only do you have the growth, the development, the associations and federations actually not just being tokenism, but putting proper development structures in place, you also now have brands starting to realize, hey, this isn't just a sport. It's actually societal. It actually does resonate and people are hugely taking up on it. And I think it's like, it's, I have two daughters, but it's, that's actually nothing to do with it. It's more the case that these athletes are fantastic and the sport is just as good and the viewership is just as good. I know the FIFA World Cup in 2019 proved that a lot, but look at the WNBA. Look at, there's a new commissioner in there, Kathy Engelbert, and what she's been doing and how their numbers have grown. And so it's, the sport is attracting and holding its own. The development side of it needs to increase and that needs more dollars and brands need to get behind that. But I'm excited to see the change, the sea change. And I think it's a huge green field for a lot of brands to get behind.
What do you suggest that that brand activity consists of? Is it like just replicating the men's game or does it require a different type? I can't think what the difference would be, but is it a different type of crowd? Is it different things required or does it, is there a new sort of creativity that's needed or is it just more money?
So, first of all, I think it'll actually be less money because the fees and rights demanded at the moment are not as large as some of the men's leagues. Certainly if you compare, say, the NBA with the WNBA or the MLS with the NWSL here in the States, or even in Europe, the Super League there along with some of the Premier League rights. So the reality is that it does cost less, which allows you for more activation dollars. But where I think that there's a huge difference is community-based. So I think it should follow the same programming as you would do with a men's team. There should be no difference. Content driving, working with players, driving the brand of the teams, programs of the major competitions, leagues, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, branding, et cetera. But what is different is there's a stronger community appreciation. There's more of an intrinsic value for you to interact with your consumers through these properties and create that gateway for them because it's more, they feel that they can relate more and touch points, stronger touch points than you could with the men's team. The chances of meeting Lionel Messi or doing a lot of content, pretty slim. The chances if you went to a game and getting Megan Rapinoe to stand in a picture with you, pretty high. So the reality is that it feels for community greater interactivity, more real, more touch points. So it gives you that stronger chance to create those moments that people look, they seek, they really want. And you have to understand how you become part of that narrative, but drive the content and create your own positioning so that you as a brand are able to leverage that positioning. But you're just using the property that you're sponsoring. So I think it gives brands more. And I think, and I'd love to see that the leagues and the properties make sure that they put those back into the development and grow the league. So, and grow the sport and grow, you know, younger girls and boys. I'd like to see boys and girls. Any youth programs we've ever done, and we've always done a lot of them, we've always included boys and girls. So I think having them play together and seeing an equal field at a young age is important.
So if there's a brand marketer listening to this thinking, right, I've got to get on top of this, I want to make my brand part of this growing opportunity in women's sport, what would you say are the sensible next steps to get started here?
It's a brilliant opportunity. It's a fantastic time because it's not just the sport that's been recognized, but it's the societal sweep change that's been happening. The conversations are a lot more fluid, open, and recognized than they ever were. So if there is a chance for you to get involved when you look at the growth, especially, as I mentioned, the two big ones being the NWSL, which have gone from 10 teams, about to be 12 teams, I see them where the MLS was 20, 30 years ago. And I see them adding franchises as they go forward, especially knowing the World Cup is here in 26. And I know that there's desire to bring the Women's World Cup here in 27. So the opportunity to get involved in the States especially, and you see the same in Europe with the growth of the all of the English teams and the Women's League in England and across Europe, coming in at a league or a team level and understanding how you influence culture and influence societal community programs with brands and how they can be part of a bigger conversation than just sport, I think it's going to be a huge advantage as we go forward in this kind of tech relevant world for interactivity, but still always being mindful of the growth of society and society's conversations being part of sport. They're not separate anymore. They're part of it.
So Kieran, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. If someone wanted to get in touch with you to talk about your kind of mad career, but also your vision for the future of the industry and the growth in women's sports, how would you like them to do that?
Yeah, I'm more than happy to have the conversations with anybody. I'm on LinkedIn, Kieran Foley-NY, I think it is. And my email is on that contact info as well. So I'm very happy to link in. I'll always reply to you. So,
and what makes a good LinkedIn outreach message to you?
Being genuine, not having a copy and paste effect or, you know, straight away ask, but try and give an understanding of the why and, you know, how it could make sense to connect. So I know a lot of people are very, very busy, but I have to say I'll always try, if someone's respectful on a message, I'll always reply, because, I mean, everybody's trying to go in the same direction. So I'd like to think that if I sent the message, someone will reply to me. So I'll always do the courtesy to try and reply.
Kieran, thank you so much for your time.
No, Tom, thanks very much. Appreciate the time, mate.
Hi, just before you go, I'd really appreciate it if you could take the time to write a review of the Shiny New Object podcast on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, whatever it's called these days, or whichever podcast provider you use. We're an indie podcast, so it would go a long way for us if you could just share the word and give us a bit of a support on those channels. That would just be fantastic. If you haven't got time, that's also cool. And yeah, if you could tell your colleagues about the podcast, and also, if possible, don't forget to subscribe. And I'd love to hear your feedback. If you'd like to speak on the podcast or be a guest, or you think I'm asking the wrong questions, anything, I'd be super interested to hear what you think. So please email me at tom@automatedcreative.net. That's T-O-M at, I'm not going to bother spelling it. Anyway, you'll work it out. Thanks so much.